You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 96. I'm Jessica Yaquinto, and I'm your host. And today we are talking about Pawnee Nation Nagpra. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch, or Ute Peoples, Treaty Lands, the Dene Ta, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. So today, we have Martha Onlyachief on the show. Ms. Onlyachief is a tribal member of the Pawnee Nation, and her band is Chawi. She is also a descendant of the Oto Mizora tribe. Ms. Onlyachief has worked the majority of her life with the Pawnee Nation in various departments. She started work with the Pawnee Nation Cultural Resource Division in 2014 in tribal historic preservation as an administrative assistant. After receiving her bachelor's degree in 2019, she was able to apply for the NAGPRA position. In 2022, she received her associate's degree in tribal business management. Her work ethics are working with other nations and tribes in consultations with universities, museums, and any entity that houses relatives, associated funerary objects, sacred objects, and cultural patrimony objects. Reburying relatives and funerary objects are the Pawnee Nation's priority. Although, to be clear, Martha is not representing the Pawnee Nation during this interview. So welcome to the show, Martha.
Nawa.
So, okay, I'm going to mix this up because I'm used to calling you Marty. So
okay.
Whenever that happens, everybody know that I'm talking about Martha. But yeah, I'm so excited to have you here. It's so fun when I get to do an interview with somebody that I work with, and it's always a good time with you, which is why up in Boulder, we decided that the word for fun is to Pawnee, right? We made it a verb.
Yes, yes it is. And I'm glad to be here. And yeah. Also glad to hear your voice again.
Yeah, always good to see you. Well, hear you, whatever. You know what I mean. So anyway, I'm also just excited to hear more about your story since we didn't get to go into that before. So what got you interested in this type of work?
Well, what has is working for my nation, the Pawnee Nation. As you've stated, I've worked in various departments, majority of my work life, and being able to go back to school and receive my degree in Native American Indian Studies, I was able to receive my bachelor's, and then I was able to apply for this position as the NAGPRA coordinator. And it's an honor to be able to take care of our relatives, our relatives, which means human remains, our funerary objects, which was with our relatives, and our sacred objects and cultural patrimony objects, which is, you know, from our past, you know, to present, trying to get and work everything out with institutions to take care of these items and our people.
How did you even, like, how did you hear about NAGPRA? Like, when did you first hear about it? And how did you know that this was a position that you could do?
I've known about NAGPRA since the 1995 Walter Echohawk, which was our president a couple of years ago, but his term ended and he started working, doing NAGPRA work with this NARF, Native American... Mm-hmm.
Rights Fund.
Yes, the Rights Fund. So he was working there, and that's when they started working on the NAGPRA. And that's when it was in Salina where we had some of our relatives where they were on a farm, and a farmer had him on his land, private property, and it was like a circus. He was charging people to see our relatives, which was, you know, embedded in stone and everything, to where they had just chiseled them out just to show their skeleton. So that's how I heard of it. And then my niece worked in this position before me. Her name was Maggie Cunningham, and she left to take a position elsewhere. So that left the position open, and I was able to apply, and I was selected to serve in this position as a NAGPRA coordinator. And I also do the coordinator position for the Culture Resource Division Director too. So,
yeah. So can you tell us a little bit more about what that work looks like on a regular basis?
Well, a couple of years ago when I first started in 2019, I was doing consultations, which was maybe 3 to 4 a year. And with the new rigs that came out, now my workload for the past year and this year is up to 43, which some of them, I think I've closed 8 of them, to which I've closed the consultation and brought our relatives to possession of our relatives and funerary objects. But right now, the priority with NAGPRA through the Pawnee Nation is our relatives and funerary objects. And then after we take care of those, then we'll go back to our sacred objects and our cultural patrimony objects as well.
So, like, can you tell us, can you explain kind of what the, or maybe give an example, I'm not sure what's easiest, of what that process is like to bring the relatives home or funerary objects?
Yes. At first, we have to do the consultation. I'll just try to go the best that I can through a past experience. I go to the institution, wherever it may be, whether it's out of state, which some of our relatives were excavated, which we came from Nebraska, and they were taken to maybe universities, and they were studying different bones or parts of our relatives. So what I do is I go over there and go through their inventory, but the Pawnee Nation only claims certain states. Our states are where we've traveled, where we've lived, where there may have been objects that refer to us, like our pottery, their cord mark around the vase, and then on the top. So there, it's different, you know, arrows. Our arrows are different from other tribes. So what I do, we have different counties and different states that we have an interest in. And then we do a consultation with other tribes if they have the same interest. And then we go from there to see who takes the lead. Once the Pawnee Nation does take possession or take the lead, then I will go to the institution, but that's after it's been published in the federal registration, which it has to be in there for 90 days to see if anybody else has any claim on there. So after that time limit is up, then I'll talk to the institution and we'll make a schedule to when I'll be up there. And then I go up there and we do paperwork and I sign off taking possession of a relative, which I have cedar boxes built for the amount of relatives that I'll bring home. So they give me an estimate on how big the box is, what they're in, if they're in bags, if they're in filing box, whatever they're in. And then I try to do a estimate on what kind of boxes to make. So from there, I drive up there because that's just how I feel, taking care of them. Just like now we take care of our folks and we're with them from the time they pass to where we can be with them until we put them away day and night. We never leave them. So that's what our protocol, which was set before I started working here, is that drive up there and then we bring them home, and we have our own land in Nebraska. We don't bring them to Oklahoma because, you know, Oklahoma was not where, to me, they knew, you know, just speaking as, you know, if they were here yesterday is how we take care of them nice and do everything. So we have our own land in Nebraska, which is private land, and it's not disclosed or anything because we don't want our relatives or our funerary objects to be excavated again. Mm-hmm. And there's not very many people that know where it's at, not even our own people, not saying that they would do it. But the less people that know, the better off to we feel that this won't happen again.
Right.
To bring them back or rebury them. And there's not like headstones or anything. If you go to that piece of land, it just looks like it's farmland.
So you drive them to this piece of land in Nebraska, and then what happens?
And then we have our cultural resource division, which is our CRD director, which is Herb Atson. We have our TIPO, which is Matt Reed. And then we have the person that conducts a Native American church member. Mm-hmm. That does our, I guess you would call it service, which they'll pray and we cedar them off and then we put them back to Mother Earth, and I buy brand new Pendletons and I place it over them before they bury them. So we basically what we do now, but it's not a reburial, I guess.
Yeah.
But the reason that there's other people there is just to make sure and that I'm doing it. We're not saying I'm doing it wrong, but to be there and witness. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. they'll ask me how we came to be there that day. And I'll tell them, you know, they came from here and who I worked with and all the people that I've worked with through these universities, museums, whatever. They've been really nice and wanting to work with me. And like I said, I'm just speaking behalf of me. I can't speak for other nations or tribes. So, and work to see if I need anything, what they need to do, or, you know, just to make everything go smooth. So then we go over there and we bury him. And just a little insight to me that makes me assure that I'm doing what I need to do is it's usually like rainy, gloomy, snowy, like bad weather. And before when we go to this land, and then right before we start putting Mother Earth or the earth on them, the sun will come out for 3 seconds, 2 seconds, and it just shines down and it'll go away and it'll start raining or it'll start snowing. And to me, I was taught, you know, when you lose a good person, those tears are happy tears that, you know, they're up in heaven and everything's going to be all right. So to me that, and I've had 4 reburials and it's done the same thing. And so to me, that assures me that I'm in the right position I need to be and doing the right thing for our relatives.
All right. Well, it's crazy how fast this always goes, but we're already at our first break point. but I'm very excited to come back afterwards and hear more about your story and this work and just to learn more from you as always. So we will be right back here in a second. Okay. So we're back, and I want to ask about, you know, so you mentioned all of these different institutions, but and how the Pawnee are connected to these different states. But obviously, like, relatives ended up, I imagine, in institutions all over. So what is, like, where are the different places that you have gone as part of this to bring relatives home?
As of last year, gosh, I'm trying to remember. I went to Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. I went to Bureau of Reclamation of Nebraska and Kansas and McCook. Mm-hmm. I went to the Denver Art Museum. It seems like I've been other places, but I just cannot think right now.
It's all blurring together.
Yes, it really is.
Well, have you noticed, like, any sort of differences between, like, I don't know, different regions or different like types of organizations, or do you feel like it's pretty similar, like the way everybody handles everything?
Okay, one more. I forgot California, but no, everybody normally will do a Zoom meeting or talk over the phone. And what that always impresses me is they'll ask me, what do I need, or what do they need to do? So, and like I always let them know, other tribes do different things. Us, you know, if we have relatives in that institution, we just want them to be left alone, not to be moved around anymore or anything. And when I go pick them up, they will take them out of the whatever they're in and put them into the cedar box. And I just overlook and watch. And then that's when we close the box up, and then I'll take them. So they're very good at working with me, and I really haven't had a problem with anybody.
Good.
So it's, yes, I did have one institution. I went to one institution. I'm not going to say their name, but that was to look over their inventory of their objects they had that were Pawnee. And she was older, and she'd been there a while. And because I was asking her, how come these objects have not been repatriated? And they were items that only are chiefs from the 1800s or early 1900s wore, you know, like now we wear modern things, but then they were the only ones who could wear certain things as leggings that has certain designs, or a shirt, buckskin shirt, or, you know, something like that. And she said that it was theirs, and I asked her, I said, it's yours? And she goes, yes, it's ours. And I was like, so you're Pawnee? And she goes, no, but it's ours. And I was like, you know, and I'm real respectful, you know. So I, instead of, you know, me saying something that I shouldn't say, I just told her, you know, I was there for a couple of days, and I said, you know, I'm just going to leave, and then I'll just come back tomorrow, and we'll talk about this again. Yeah. And then, so I left, and then we came back, and I think I told another person, and because she knew I was kind of upset, and I told her what happened. So I believe they talked to the older lady, and I just came back the next day, and I just said, you know, I'm being respectful and being nice, but we're going to have our Pawnee delegation, which is our president, and we're having some of our Lasharo chiefs, which is chiefs from all different bands, which we have four bands, as you stated. You know, I'm from the Chawi band. We have the Kickahawkee band. We have the Pitahawidata band. And then we have the Skeedy band. So there was some delegation that was coming up there, you know, to look at the inventory that I looked at. So I just tried to tell her that they're not Pawnee, and to please do not say that in front of them, because I was being nice and these were men coming, and I don't think they'd be really rude, but they would probably say something at that time. So, mm-hmm. And then she apologized, and, you know, and I just left it at that. So that's the only one bad thing that's ever happened to me. And like I said, I've been doing this since 2019. And that was like the first year too.
Yeah. So you got a nice taste, right?
Yes. I had. Yeah. I was like, oh, this is, and then I had that one. I was like, oh, wow. Wait.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, sounds like a good approach where you like explained, but then, you know, stepped away and gave her the night to kind of process what you were saying.
Yes.
Instead of like going into it right then. That seems like, you know, like, and then that way she was able to like take the time and be and think about what you were saying and come back and apologize. It seems like a smart approach.
Yes, it worked for me.
Yeah. Yeah. So you were saying too that like that you really like, you know, people asking what you need and recognizing that that each tribe is different. Are there any other recommendations that you would give for organizations that are working through the NAGPRA process?
Yes. Don't assume that all tribes do the same thing. Like we use cedar, you know, people will say smudge, you know, I don't know what smudge is, but I think it's basically same thing, but cedar, but how they use it and the way they use it is different. So I guess don't assume that we all do the same thing or we all need the same thing. Like some tribes, they use the red felt and use different kind of materials. And so it's been, you know, good that they ask, you know, what I need. I don't know about, they probably do the other tribes. That way it's not a mistake, like trying to give me stuff to smudge and I have no clue on, that's not what we do. So. Mm-hmm.
Any other, like, have you ever had to kind of negotiate with other tribes on approach and what has worked well for you there?
Yes. We just had one in Kansas. And like, well, I spoke about it earlier. We claim different states and so there's other tribes that claim some of the states we do because we all traveled and went to like Colorado. But most of all the tribes went to Colorado because in Nebraska, when we were basically almost getting pushed off our land and settlers were coming in there and killing all the buffalo just for entertainment, which was our food, that's when, you know, a lot of tribes would start traveling to Colorado because that's where they would calf. The bison would calf their babies and, you know, and it was a certain time of year that we would go and then we'd come back. Or some of them, you know, lived there or might have lived there, that maybe that's why we're finding different items around there. And there's different areas that's Taos, that Pawnee's been there. You know, we have like Pikes Peak. We have different, there's a mountain, I believe, in Colorado that I can't remember what the name, but anyway, there, it identifies that we were there. So, and the other states that we do claim is Kansas. We don't claim Oklahoma because we did not, our ancestors did not live here. So that's when we were removed from Nebraska and forced to Oklahoma. And then we also have an interest in Iowa, Missouri, South Dakota, of course, Nebraska, Colorado. I might be leaving, South Dakota, Wyoming. And all these areas that I've mentioned, it's not the whole state, it's just certain counties. And normally the counties that we claim and we have referenced to different things that have been found there is we lived by water, rivers, streams. So if the counties that we claim, you could tell there was some kind of water flowing through there or by there. And we do go into consultation in other tribes. So how we go about it is the county and why is it that they feel or we feel that we should claim it. And our TIPO officer, Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, Matt, he has Google Maps and it has every burial every sacred site, every village. He has everything pinned on there. So we work together, and if we're going to consultation, they usually give us a spreadsheet that shows the exact area. Anyway, he has everything on there, so that's how we go. We could go through it very fast and see what we have interest or would like to claim. And we don't, the tribes and the nations, we don't argue or fight over, you know, these relatives. And I say relatives is because we can't say they're Pawnee, you know, and we're not going to have them test to see if they're Pawnee because right. They've already went through enough. So that's why I say relatives. And, you know, if they have a higher importance, then I'll defer. So we're working real good with each other. And it hasn't been, you know, chaos. Everything just kind of flows. So I think, like I said, you know, the institutions give us paperwork before and we could go through there. And then once there's certain tribes that claim or have interest, then we work through it. And then one will take the lead and the other ones will say they have an interest just to be on the Federal Register to show that we had interest in that county for whatever reason.
But then it gets basically sorted between all of you based on who feels like the strongest connection, essentially.
Yes. Yes.
So another thing to kind of switch topics here real quick. So you were talking about the shirt that the chiefs would wear?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was making me think, because you had been talking before about reburials in Nebraska, but like sacred objects of cultural patrimony, would those also go to Nebraska or would those go to Pawnee, or are they treated differently basically?
Yes, the human remains and the funerary objects, anything that we claim through consultation or anything, we rebury them. I mean, for instance, I went to New York, Numismatic Society, where they have all the coins from the beginning of people till now. But they had one of our chief medals.
Mm.
And you could tell on the back of it, you know, if you put any kind of metal on a human, it's going to like tarnish on there. And so, you know, none of our Pawnee people here, not even I, have seen it in person. And we're not going to keep something like that, which we know was buried with one of our chiefs, because it only went to the, you know, the chiefs. So it was reburied. So once again, you know, we would have liked to keep it and, you know, show our people, this is what, you know, this is one of the medals. And those are very few medals that were given out to tribes through to their chiefs. But, you know, that was buried with one of our chiefs. So it's not like we're keeping things. What is we're doing as funerary objects and human remains will go back into the ground. So the sacred objects and the cultural patrimony is totally different. The sacred objects, for instance, you know, they could have in their inventory at a museum, it says a rattle. Well, a rattle, it depends on what kind of, how it's made. We still do sacred ceremony dances. So these objects would only be used during this time. It's not just to be used throughout the year. It's only certain times of the year. So that would be a sacred object. And then we have cultural patrimony objects. So that's just trying to clarify the difference between a funerary and the sacred and the cultural. So anything that we do as reburial or anything that has been with our relatives beside them, then we rebury them. We do not keep them.
Well, again, it's always crazy, but we're at the end of our second. I know, it goes so fast.
I'm talking too much, though.
No, it's that is the point, in fact.
That's so crazy.
I know, it's crazy, but...
Time goes by when you have fun, huh?
Right, exactly. So on that note, everyone that's listening will be on the edge of their seat during the commercial break and ready for you to come back and keep talking about this. So we will be right back. Okay, back from our break. And Marty, you were just telling me over the break, because we always have the best conversations over the break. And I'm always just not recording. You were telling me a really good piece of advice you've had for some people that you've worked with from different agencies and institutions. So if you want to share that story, that would be awesome.
Yes, I was explaining to Jessica over the break that when we're on a Zoom meeting or if we're on the phone, you know, I know people are nervous speaking to tribes or nations. And so just a little quick experience. I was speaking to this one individual and he was talking like fast, like really fast. And then I finally said, hey, I'm not going to mention names. I said, you need to slow down. I said, I can't understand what you're saying. Everything's going to be right. Everything's going to be right. And I said, you're talking so fast. He goes, I'm so sorry. I'm nervous and I'm scared. I said, you cannot do anything wrong. I'm just a normal person. We're just trying to take care of these relatives. Everything's going to work out. Everything's going to be all right. And then after that, we become good friends and we still text each other. He just had a new baby last year. And then I seen him at the Kansas summit that we had where different tribes and nations met to go over KU's inventory, Kansas State inventory, and Kansas Historical Society, and then the other two, then they was there. I'll just say Tennessee. He was there, and his name was Zach. He was real awesome. But also, like I said, I'm speaking on my own personal experiences. I let them know, you know, what happened and why our relatives and why our things are there is not their fault. And all we're trying to do is correct on what had happened decades before May, you know, or whenever, you know, and then trying to make everything right to where we could take care of our relatives and bring back our objects for some reason, you know, they have them. And, you know, just like, I think it's been 3 years ago, I just repatriated from the Gilcrease Museum in Tulsa, Oklahoma, our bear claw necklaces, which back, you know, in the 1800s, only our warriors or chief wore them. Now you see in society now, everybody's wearing them. So that significant on why they were wearing them is gone. It's just to represent, you know, being Pawnee, and the Pawnees used to wear that. So, and one of our bear claw necklaces is here in our Pawnee Nation Museum to wear. I cannot think of who the chief was, or they did not have the identification on who had it. But now our people can see it because some people don't have the transportation. Where I live is a small town. You know, just like bringing back our items from whether it be Chicago Film Museum, Denver, you know, our people won't be able to go these places to see these things. And to me, it's emotional because with my job, I can go, you know, go through the inventory and I can actually see, and sometimes it's overwhelming, you know, and sometimes, you know, it makes me cry. I'm about ready to cry thinking about it now, to see these items that only heard about it in stories, only seen it in pictures, only seen them talked in oral history, but then to actually see it, it's overwhelming emotionally. And, you know, that's another thing, you know, that we're not trying to take everything from all the museums, because we still want individuals that go to these museums to know that, you know, we're still here, you know, we're alive, you know, it's not what you see in movies, it's not what you see in pictures, you know. And so that's what I'm trying to explain, is the things we want to bring back is some of the things that our people will never see, our children, my children's never seen, and my grandchildren has never seen. So that's what we're trying to do, is, you know, bring it to where our people can see these items and not just to see them as a picture.
So, yeah, I mean, I imagine, obviously, sounds like really intense experiences, like having those moments. And I imagine working with relatives and that whole process of reburial can be pretty heavy, I would imagine. How do you deal with that personally?
Personally, before I even start to travel, I burn cedar and I pray, and I stay in that prayer, and it's never, I mean, I always have in my head, you know, I'll just talk about my first repatriation. That was in 2019, right after I was able to get in this position. And we had went to, I think it was History of Nebraska is what it was called then. Anyway, we went up there and we was picking up relatives. And like I said, this is my first, you know, repatriation. And, you know, it's in Nebraska, so we're just going to go ahead and pick them up and then rebury them. Well, I had made, I think they said, and it was locker-sized boxes, cedar chests. And I believe I made 14 of those. And anyway, I was in there and, you know, there was, and the tipper was with me, Matt. They was taking everything out of the sacks. They were in sacks. They were boxes. They don't just dump them out, you know. They handle them respectfully and then place them in there. And I was standing there and we was overlooking them. And then I seen these craniums, and there were baby craniums, and then there was, you know, adult craniums, and then there was, you know, some of the funerary objects were cradle boards. So, oh man, it was so overwhelming, and it just felt like somebody was just sitting on my chest. It was so emotional. I could feel the sadness. That's what I felt, you know, something. Anyway, I told Matt, so I have to walk out. I have to walk out. I said, I can't hardly breathe. It feels like somebody's sitting on my chest, or somebody put bricks on my chest. And so I went outside and I prayed, you know, and asked, you know, God to help me. You know, this is the work I have to do. This is the work I'm going to have to do. So I need to be strong, you know, for our relatives, and do the best that I can. So anyway, I came back in, and it wasn't all lifted up, you know, but it was, I felt better. And then they started putting them into these boxes, and there were so many, because we had four-door truck, what is it, Ford F-150 or whatever, and we had to rent a U-Haul just to put all our relatives in and take them to this place who's going to rebury him. And we normally stay overnight and then rebury him, and then we'll head back home. So from home to Pawnee to where we bury them, it's like 8 hours. So we always bury them in the morning around like 10 a.m. And it's always the same time. So that's just and then when we're there, then they'll ask me how we came to be there, you know, as I spoke earlier. And the roadman, which I was trying to remember the title, the roadman, I guess, is like a preacher at a church. And he'll cedar us off and pray for us. And this is just what I've heard, you know, from, we don't tell them what to say. They just say it from their heart. But they always apologize for what happened to our relative. To them, he speaks to them and apologize for what happened to them, and that we're trying to do the best that we can to, you know, put them back and to Mother Earth and to continue their journey, or you know, what needs to be done to where they won't be bothered or removed or disturbed anymore. So I guess, and then so when he does that, he cedars me off, and I always think, I'm not going to cry. And every time I cry, because it's so emotional to talk about these relatives of where they came from and how it became to where we're at that time. So it's really hard. I'm trying not to cry right now.
You're allowed to cry. It's okay.
It's so emotional because I can just see it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Trying not to, didn't mean to put you into like trauma.
No, you're fine.
Situation. That's, like,
it's okay. It's, you know, that's what I'm always asked, you know, how do I do it? And it's not easy, but you know, this is what I chose, and, as a caregiver in my family, which I take care of my family and will go out of my way and drop everything for anybody. So that's just me. So this position that I work in was meant for me for some reason. It's how I became to be here.
Yeah. Well, and you know, with all of this NAGPRA experience and other experience that you've had, what would be your hope for this type of work in the future?
My hope is to where there won't be a need for NAGPRA.
Yeah.
But that's hard to be hopeful for when you have construction around sacred sites, around burials, all these wind farms, and you know, nothing's going to stop being built or anything like that. So I don't feel it's going to stop, but I feel it'll slow down once all the nations and tribes get their relatives back from all the institutions.
Yeah, like the ones that have been sitting there for 100 years.
Yes.
Sometimes.
And why, I have no clue. But that's my hope. Yeah. And I know it will. You know, it's not going to be like it has been. And like I said, as myself, you know, I let the past go. I'm just trying to do the best that I can to do what I need to do to take care of the things I have to take care of for our nation, for our people, for, you know, our relatives. You know, that could be my grandpa, you know, that could have been my, you know, my uncle, you know, I don't know, you know, but just that responsibility to take care of them the way I do and will always, as if they were my own. So that gives me not satisfaction, but it makes me feel good that I can do this. Because I'm getting old. I need to go on Social Security if it's going to still be around. No.
Oh, God. Yeah.
I had to throw humor in there because I was getting too sad.
It's getting too dark. Well, So going that route then, following your lead, is there like any highlights that you want to share? Like just to close us out, we're already like right at the end, but anything like that has stood out to you from doing this work that's been, you know, positive, made you smile, made you laugh, whatever.
Okay. Yes, I've done this in an interview. I think it was with the NAGPRA Circle or whatever, but a story of I went to Maryland to pick up relatives. It was a young boy and it was adult male. And when we say pick up relatives, it's hardly ever a full skeleton of our relatives. It may be, like I said, cranium or whatever. But anyway, I went up there and drove up there. I went halfway and I stayed in Nashville, but picked them up. And then we just come back I was going to Nashville and I always talked to them, you know, and I had music on. So I said, okay, you know, I'm turn country on because, you know, the only thing you've heard is, you know, the heartbeat of the drum, you know, because that was back in Nebraska. They came from, like, they were late 1800s is when they found them. So anyway, I had country. I said, I don't think you'd want to hear rock and roll. You know, that probably freak you out hearing all that screaming around or whatever. and then I said, I don't know. You might like hear some R&B, but I said, we'll just stay with country. And then so I started talking to that little boy, and I was like, you know, I'm a grandma, and, you know, I have three boys, you know, then I have grandchildren, I have grandsons. And I was like, I wonder, you know, if he was like shy or if he was like ornery or if he was like to terrorize and tease or if he was just funny, you know. Anyway, I was just talking to him, you know, and then I pulled into Nashville and I pulled into the hotel and went in, and I don't take them in with me. And anyway, I got my suitcase, went up there, and I was laying there and watching TV, and I started getting hungry, and I was like, I'm gonna go get me something to eat. So I jumped back in my Jeep, you know, and said, hey, you know, I'm sorry. I said, I gotta get me something to eat. I'm hungry, I'm starving. So I went through the drive-thru and then came back to my room, set my little dinner up, and I grabbed the remote because I turned it off and hit the power, and I was like, oh my gosh, it won't come on. I was like, oh. So I did. I always call it the ceremony. Took the batteries out, switched them up, put them back in, and it wouldn't come on. And I was like, oh my gosh, I am not going to call the front desk and say my TV won't work and it's something, you know, dumb, you know. So anyway, so I got my laptop out and I laid it on that desk and laid it by my bed. So I was just laying there and I was watching Netflix on my laptop, and then all of a sudden heard noises, and I rolled over and my TV came on, and I was like, Okay, so you're telling me you're ornery and you like to tease.
You're naughty.
So people always say, be careful what you ask for. But I asked him, you know, I wonder if he was quiet. And I was like, okay, you like to tease. Okay, now I'm getting ready to eat and I'm going to bed. So you just leave me alone. And I started cracking up. So that was just one of my experiences. There's been more, but you know, like I said, I'm a grandma and I'm a mom. I have three boys, and just to, you know, wander and things like that is what goes through my mind when we pick up our relatives, you know, when they're young or if they're, you know, older or anything like that. So, but just a little story experience of one of mine during my consultation and bringing them back for reburial.
I love it. Yeah, that's
That's cute. Just imagine a little boy like,
I know. That's like, oh, I know. I was like, oh my gosh. So he was honoring. I bet you just terrorized and teased everybody, just hit things or whatever.
Well, that is a lovely note to end on. I have a big old smile on my face, and I'm sure everybody listening to this too.
You.
Yes. Well, I just want to say thank you so much for coming on and sharing and for doing this work. You know, obviously it's not the easiest work in the world to do, but it is very important, like you said. So appreciate it. Appreciate you. Always a good time to get to hang out with you. So thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me and let me tell my stories, my experiences. You know, like I said, it's an emotional roller coaster in this position. It's never easy and it's never hard. So
that's a good way of putting it.
Yes. Thank you, Jessica. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Marty. Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices' amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.